Hello and welcome to On Sacred Ground on the LMC Radio Network on Blog Talk Radio, broadcasting the voices of the land and of the dead by weaving together history, ethnography, and spiritual experience. I'm your host, Kai Armand, and if you're tuning in online and having technical issues, remember that you can listen to the show by calling in via your phone or Skype to 657-383-0525. That's 657-383-0525. And to those of you who are listening live and are in the chat room at blogtalkradio.com, welcome and thank you so much for tuning in. This is our 11th episode of On Sacred Ground, broadcasting live at 3 p.m. Eastern, 12 p.m. Pacific on this March 14th, 2015. And as many people are pointing out in the chat room, today is Pi Day. Pi being P-I, that mathematical formulation known as 314, and that is today. So it's a special day for nerdy folks all over the world. And on this episode, we'll be having a return of our very special guest, Conjurman Ali, internationally renowned djinn conjurer, root doctor, mage, sorcerer, writer, just truly an incredible person for us to have on Earth at this time. And I'm so privileged that he not only would be a guest on the show, but be a guest for a second time, because the last time we had him on was such a riveting conversation. And today will be no less of one. And today is a call-in show. If you have any questions for myself or for the great mage himself, Conjurman Ali, or would like to discuss the topic, which today is a continuation of the conversation we were having a few weeks ago on djinn spirits and geomantic divination. So, being a call-in show, if you have any questions, thoughts, or comments, please do call in to 657-383-0525 and dial 1 so that I know that you're in the queue, as I'd love to have you on. As we do every show, we'll be beginning this episode from the book Earth Prayers from Around the World, 365 Prayers, Poems, and Invocations for Honoring the Earth. This poem is a short one, and it reads, I entrust myself to Earth. Earth entrusts herself to me. I entrust myself to Buddha. Buddha entrusts herself to me. And we're going to go right to introducing our wonderful guest, Conjurman Ali. Are you here?
I am. Thank you for that generous and unfailingly kind introduction. It was very kind of you.
Oh, unfailingly true. Unfailingly true. Thank you so much for joining us. Welcome to March. I feel like this year is happening so quickly.
I know, it is going by so fast. I remember, you know, it was only a few months ago when we were face to face, and yet it's already March. Thank you for having me on again on this fantastic show. I'm very excited to be here.
So I'm sure people would love to know what keeps Conjurman Ali busy. I know that you have lots of clients. I know that you're also doing a lot of reading and writing. What are things looking like for you as of recent, as we're heading into, at least for my end in New York, the snow is finally melting. So I'm noticing some changes. I don't know what people in your realm of the world notice in terms of seasonal changes.
Oh, yeah. The seasons always bring out very interesting changes in regards to work activity and clients. And I live in Southern California, which is blessed with Mediterranean weather. But for someone like myself who actually enjoys the cold, we have 2 weeks of winter. So I am dreading the fact that we're already, I mean, winter hasn't ended and we're already hitting the 90s and 80s where I am. But that has a natural, you know, reaction, or has a natural effect, I should say, on the client base. This period of time is always very, very busy for me. So I have had quite a bit of clients coming in, people who are interested in geomancy readings, people who are interested in just tarot readings, lots of work in regards to root work and djinn conjuration. And in my day job as a historian, I have been quite swamped, which I like. As many people know, I am a Taurus, so not being busy for me is a bad thing. I enjoy being busy. But I have two conferences coming up in the next 2 weeks, one here in Southern California, one in San Francisco, that I have been preparing for, and have three publications that I need to finish by the end of next week. So it has, in addition to root work and spiritual work, it has been fantastically busy, but I wouldn't have it any other way, to be honest with you. I wouldn't have it any other way.
Well, as we were just discussing before the show started, you know, idle hands are the devil's workshop. So,
keeping busy is good
for all of us. I know that my idle hands are very, very good at scrolling through my Facebook feed mindlessly. So that's, the devil has definitely had me very busy with such acts.
And for someone like me, I truly consider Facebook to be the great devil sometimes.
It is information overload. Oh, our age.
Yes.
But one thing you mentioned right now, and I think it's a great seg into today's discussion. Again, thank you for coming back to talk more on these incredible topics. You mentioned some folks come to you for geomantic divination and some for tarot readings. Now, I don't think that many people in our audience, of course, we're going to talk about what geomancy is, but I don't think that many people in our audience would even know that there are people who make a delineation in terms of the kind of divinatory form, you know, the kind of divinatory tool they would prefer a spiritual practitioner to use. So what would you say, who's coming to you and saying, I want this kind of divination? And for those of you who might not have ever heard the term geomancy, like tarot, like scrying, like throwing bones, is a form of divination by which a spirit worker or a layperson will ascertain information regarding the past, the present, the future, to gain a deeper glimpse into the workings of life toward better decision-making, etc. So who's coming to you for geomancy specifically?
That's a fantastic question. And I think this is a question that people who work and do spiritual work specifically take note of. I've talked to my dear colleague Kat about this, and I've talked to you about this, but how you can kind of tell which clients want which type of readings, especially those of us that do multiple types of divination and reading practices. People, for example, that are American-based or in Western society, I should say, more often than not are looking for certain types of readings, tarot being one of the most popular, followed up by probably astrology. Not that many people are asking for geomancy readings for my American clientele, but it is growing as geomancy's reputation grows. More and more people are asking for. But for example, I'm also known in the Middle East and North Africa for the work that I do with the jinn and geomancy, and I have nobody from over there asking for tarot readings. None of them. I can't think of a single client that asks that. Every single client that I have astrology readings or geomancy readings, and that's all they're looking for. More often than not, coinciding with the birth of a child, a new business endeavor. All of my business retainer clients are also from the Middle East, are geomancy and astrology. But what I find interesting is that times are changing. Thanks to globalization and the influence of the internet and popular books like John Michael Greer's book, geomancy is on the rise here in the so-called Western world as well. And so I'm starting to see clients that are not from a Middle Eastern background, not from a North African background, asking for geomancy readings. And they usually ask by saying, can I have a geomancy reading? Whereas people from the Middle East will ask for Khat al-Ramal, or they'll say, do you know Ilm al-Ramal, the knowledge of the sand? And I'll say yes and provide that type of reading. But it is interesting to kind of note the differences of what people are looking for in regards to divination.
So you mentioned right now that there's another term for geomancy, that Khat al-Ramal, reading of the sand. I think that's a great segue. What is geomancy and what is Khat al-Ramal? Are these the exact same thing? Are there differences between geomancy and Khat al-Ramal?
There are. Geomancy is a term that comes out of the Greek, and it refers specifically to a practice that was adopted from the North African and Middle Eastern tradition of Khat al-Ramal. Now, Khat al-Ramal has a variety of different names. Khat al-Ramal means sand cutting, quite literally. And then it's also called Ilm al-Ramal, meaning the knowledge of the sand. And then in other parts of Africa, specifically in Sudan and those regions, it's sometimes called Darb al-Ramal, which is making dots in the ground. And the reason it's called this is because traditionally geomancy or Khatalrama was done by means of sand and people making lines and dots and cuts into the sand, a random amount of them, which would then generate a sort of chart through calculation and mixing the figures together. Over time, it has evolved to the point where people had instruments to use to create the chart or the figures that we use for divination. I myself do geomancy on the radio show, The Lucky Mojo Hoodoo Rootwork Hour, with my wonderful co-host, Catherine Ironwood, and it's impossible for me to do it by hand because of the timing issues. So what I use are Rammel dice, which are a set of dice. There are four die that have either an odd number of figures, odd number of dots on there, or even, and they're connected by a bar that you spin in your hand and then throw down. And you throw them down four times to generate the figure. There are other means of creating the figures as well. People have sandboxes, small boxes that became very popular during the Renaissance, as well as wax tablets that were used to generate these figures. But the reason it's called Khatalrama is that it was traditionally done with sand. Nowadays, people use paper and pen. It's great. You can use this type of divination on the go, wherever you are. I'm actually quite notorious for casting charts in the middle of conversation to check on rumor and gossip, so it's great in those regards. But to go back to the original question of, is there a difference? The answer is yes. Geomancy is the adoption of Khatalrama into the Western magical tradition, specifically taking on certain Greek characteristics, merging with Renaissance Platonic philosophy, and it is different slightly, not entirely. The person who practices geomancy would recognize certain things in Khatalrama, and someone who practices Khatalrama will recognize certain things in geomancy. But there are enough differences that I would consider them two branches of a larger umbrella of tradition. They emphasize very different things sometimes, and language-wise, the way they're spoken about is different. I actually wrote a small blog piece about the differences between them, and I can go into further detail later on if people are interested about what those differences are. But Khatalrama, when I mention that, I'm talking about the Middle Eastern tradition, though sometimes I use geomancy interchangeably. And if you're listening to the show, I have read that blog post that you're mentioning. Conjurman Ali's blog is ravenconjure.blogspot.com. Don't go over there just yet because we're still talking. But after the show, definitely go over and look for that blog post because it's very, very, very interesting. So one thing that you mentioned was that you are sometimes sitting in conversations, say, with friends of your age, and people are chatting and, gossip is being thrown around, and you're busy making dots on a piece of paper that you're sort of calculating up to find so that you can say, well, that is not true in terms of something that someone just said. Is that correct? That's absolutely true. I consider there are various practices that I had, abilities that I have that are considered my core, the secrets of my success, if you will, and one of them is definitely geomancy. It gives this fantastic impression of being all-knowing, which is not true, but it works out quite well, even for people who don't know anything about spiritual practices. My academic friends, for example, jokingly call me the oracle because I seem to know everything, which, again, isn't true, but geomancy gives you that advantage. It's a great tool to use in those cases. My favorite moment of using geomancy was actually at a restaurant called Macaroni Grill. And for people who are familiar with this restaurant puts a large paper down for a tablecloth and they give you crayons so that you can draw on there. And in midst conversation, I was using a crayon and that paper tablecloth to cast a chart determining if there was really an affair going on amongst two of my colleagues. So geomancy is fantastic, and it's one of the reasons why I enjoy it so much is that I can do it anywhere. I can be in the middle of a class or a lecture. We're just talking among friends and casting the chart, checking certain things out. And for me, I consider it one of the keys of my success because it's how I plan things as well, how I strategize, how I determine what my next move is, which path I should take, which endeavors I should take on, which projects I should undergo. Geomancy helps me make those decisions.
Well, you're definitely well-versed in multiple divination forms. What would you say are the strengths of geomancy versus, say, reading with the tarot?
This is a great question. I've become known as a tarot reader in the West, and I do love the tarot. Undoubtedly, it's a fantastic divination system. But if I had to pick three forms of divination, if I had to pick my core divination, the stuff that I use for myself, I can honestly say I have rarely pulled cards for myself. Rarely. It's not a common practice for me. I pull cards for clients. I will either scry using a ring that I wear, and this is part of the Jin tradition. I will either scry for myself. That's another thing I often do out in public. As someone is talking, I'll peer into my ring. Astrology is the one that I use quite a bit because it helps with long-term planning, and geomancy. And one of the benefits of geomancy is that it's quick. It's something you can do anywhere. I don't have to have a deck with me. I can do geomancy readings with a pen and paper wherever I am. My notebooks are filled with notes, and then off to the side, they'll have a chart that I've drawn up. The other thing that makes it fantastic as a divination system is that it's very direct. And readers who work with multiple forms of divination will often talk about the divination tools as having a personality or spirit, and to a certain extent, this is true. And the personality and spirit of geomancy is quite blunt. It is a binary system, so it's meant to give yes or no answers. Whereas the tarot requires quite a deal of interpretation, and there's room for ambiguity. With geomancy, not so much. Geomancy is a very blunt system. It's either yes or it's no. Either the question you're asking about is going to happen or it's not going to happen. And then that's the surface level. If you're looking for a quick answer, yes, no, there you go. But then looking at the chart, you're able to pull out some fantastic details. Geomancy is geared specifically at those details. It's that perfect combination of interpretive divination as well as the more mathematical or formulaic, like astrology. And so geomancy can do things like tell you exactly the birth sign and characteristics of a future lover. It can tell you in which room a missing object is. It can tell you which direction a thief has gone in. It can tell you whether a person is lying or not and how to find out or get them to confess that they're lying. So it pulls out these really specific details that I think gives it an advantage over other forms of divination. I love that you mentioned the spirit of geomancy, because that is something mm-hmm. that I think a lot of people, I don't think a lot of people think about when it comes to divination systems. You know, obviously, mm-hmm. if you're coming from an animistic worldview, everything has a spirit. And when we start thinking about the spirit of the tools that have been being used for centuries, for millennia, and how those spirits speak to us, they can sometimes begin to provide a key into not only understanding that divination tool, but maybe a better understanding of how we can work with it. If I'm expecting a tarot-like message from geomancy, which, as you said, is very blunt. When I've in my few experiences with working with geomancy, it does. It feels like a very blunt older dude who's just like, yes, no, yep.
over there.
Whereas
tarot is kind
absolutely.
Of a in my experience, kind of a fancy, philosophical older lady. She has a lot of great ideas, and she's providing a lot of different options, and your interpretation is sort of just as important as the cards that are coming up. Whereas, because geomancy is working with, I believe, 16 symbols, correct?
Yes, 16 symbols.
Yeah, then we're really zooming in to a much smaller amount of probability, a much smaller degree of probability. You and my conversations with you before this episode, you mentioned that Hatharamel includes mm-hmm. A prescriptive aspect to it that you don't find in geomancy.
Yeah.
Can you speak a bit to that?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is really one of the differences between geomancy as it's practiced in the Renaissance tradition and the Western tradition, and Hatharamel as it's practiced today. I theorize, and I could be wrong about this, but the historian in me theorized the reason this element is missing in geomancy is because geomancy died out. Geomancy is being reconstructed today by some very adept practitioners based off of the text, but Hatharamel has always existed. It's a living tradition. And so that element was preserved. Geomancy has predictive and diagnostic capabilities. It predicts things and diagnoses what's going wrong. But the prescriptive element of geomancy is missing. Hatharamel retains the prescriptive element. So there's three parts to it. If you ask a question, right, will I get engaged with, you know, to this woman, right? And you cast a chart, it can say, you know, prediction, no, and it'll diagnostic, why not? Well, it looks like there's someone else in the picture. But then there's also the prescriptive element. It'll tell you what you can do following up. The prescriptive element of Fatal Ramal is also deeply related to medicinal qualities and healing qualities. Geomancy was used by healers. These were people who would often use folk healing methods on their clients, people who would come with toothaches and body aches, people who were asking about the birth of their children, people who were asking about pregnancy, people who were asking about headaches and whatnot. And it was tied to two very specific forms of medical practice in North Africa and in the Middle East. In the Middle East, what's known as Yunani, which is a type of Greco-Arabic healing practice that involves holistic approach towards what type of fruits to eat, what type of foods to avoid, what type of things to do. And that's that prescriptive element. So if a client were to come to me and ask, you know, I'm having difficulties in my life, I can't seem to hold down a job, and I cast the chart, I can predict whether this person will find a job or not. I can guide why they're not finding a job. And then I can prescribe. And the prescription may include something along the lines of, you know, your spirit is overheated. I want you to avoid hot foods for a period of time. I want you to say these certain prayers and burn this incense. And this will help to realign you spiritually. So there's a very deep healing aspect to geomancy, to Khatal Ramal, that we don't always find in geomancy today. And this is related, I would say, to the wider African healing practices of Ifa and Dilegun, because you also find that part of the prescription involves storytelling. The figures are connected with certain stories and figures, and they tell you what the prescription is based on the story that comes up.
Figures are connected to certain stories. When you mention the Dilegun, okay, so I understand the Dilegun, which is the Ifa practice of divination using cowrie shells, and that when a certain amount of cowrie shells fall, either face up or face down, then these are pointing towards a story known as a pitaki, that is a Yoruban legend or myth that includes both the sort of issue at play in the querent's life as well as the solution to it. So you're saying that each of the symbols, each of the 16 symbols used in geomancy also has a story attached to it.
Absolutely. And some of these stories, and these stories vary. They're not, again, when I talk about Khatal Ramal, I'm talking about a family of practices. It's not a monolithic tradition. So the stories that are told in Iran, for example, are going to be vastly different from the story that will be told in the Sudan. But they involve both religious stories, stories that are pulled from the Bible, stories that are pulled from the Quran, as well as stories that are more local or folk stories. For example, in Central Asia, a certain combination of figures will refer to a figure known as Ghawth-i-Azam. Ghawth-i-Azam is a Sufi saint that's very popular in Central Asia, but you're not going to find him coming up very often in a practitioner that's practicing it in Nigeria. But in Nigeria, you may find Khatal Ramal refers to, you know, the figure of Moses, for example. So there are variations in the stories, but they all have a story-based element that's tied to both the prescriptive element, the diagnostic element, and the predictive element.
Now, one of the things that someone is in the chat room who has asked is how long you've been practicing geomancy, and you mentioned that you've been, in the last episode, that you've been practicing, that learning Khatal Ramal was a part of your upbringing, that you are the heir to a very long line of spirit workers and practitioners, and it was sort of required that you had mentorship in these arts. The moment you sort of got here, send thee to the temple and get to work.
That's very true. I had an odd childhood.
Was learning some of these stories, was this a part of your training?
Yes, absolutely. I've been practicing Khatal Ramal for over 20 years now. And the reason it takes so long to practice to do this is because the training is intense. It's not something you can pick up in a year even. It's something that you spend a long time memorizing the stories. And Miss Michael in the chat asks that, you know, there are stories associated with certain figures that sound analogous to the pictures of the modern Tarot. And yes, to a certain extent, they certainly are. There is stories associated with the Tarot as well. But one of the things about this type of learning, and this is what I call tradition-based learning, is that it first requires a heavy level of memorization before you even start the interpretive elements. So you spend many, many years memorizing the stories associated with one figure. There's 16 of them. And then there's stories associated with combinations of figures, right? So there's 16 figures and there's combinations that come up. Three of those figures appear in the court of the Tacht, of the shield, if you will. And those combinations have stories associated with them. And so you have to spend all that time memorizing. And you do start off very young. From what I know, in most of the traditions in North Africa and the Middle East, Khatal Ramal isn't taught later in life. I don't know many people that pick it up later. It generally is something that you start off very early doing, memorizing all those different stories before you can even practice it. And then after the memorization of not just the stories, but the stories, the correspondences, then you have to take a series of tests. And again, they vary from region to region, but it's known as an ijaza, which is a licensing. Everything in the jinn tradition and the geomancy and the Khatal Ramal tradition is associated with lineage and testing. You have to prove your abilities. And a person has an ijaza, a license to practice that art. In order to be licensed to work Khatal Ramal, after you've memorized all the stories and all the correspondences and associations, you then have to do a series of tests, and they vary. Some are known as the test of 33, some are known as the test of 99, and they're very specific conditions. So can you locate a thief? And then you have to be able to cast the chart, locate the thief, recite the proper story, give the proper diagnosis and prediction, and also offer a prescription. Frank Rising says that it sounds very similar to De La Goon with the and that's absolutely true. It does sound very similar to De La Goon and Ifa, and that's because Khatal Ramal is part of that wider body of African divination practices, I would say.
Would you say that, in your experience, even the 16 symbols of Khatal Ramal and geomancy, would you say that each of these even have a spirit of their own?
Absolutely, absolutely. And this goes into jinn magic. The figures themselves in geomancy are associated with jinn. So Khatal Ramal cannot be divorced from the wider practices of working with the jinn. You cannot practice Khatal Ramal. Geomancy is a separate thing. You can practice it whichever way you like. But Khatal Ramal, you cannot practice it without a connection to the jinn. And a lot of Khatal Ramal practitioners will have one or two jinn that they work with specifically as spirits of divination that assists with the overall chart, but each figure itself is connected with either famous jinn or jinn that you come across or jinn that you learn about. And those jinn lend a certain character to the figure, as well as hinting at what type of magical work can be done. The figures themselves feature quite prominently in talismanic magic. You will use those figures to craft talismans that invoke the power of certain jinn as well as certain angels. And then the talisman is imbued with that power. It's given to a client as part of the prescription. Carry this talisman on you for 30 days and it will return your husband to you. Carry this talisman on you for 30 days and it will break the evil eye, and so on and so forth.
And these are talismans that are made using the geomantic symbols. That's absolutely incredible, and it's really the perfect seg, because as some people in the chat room are asking, they're saying, when do we get back to the gym? So we're really, really right on time, and I'm excited about merging these two conversations that we've been having over an episode and a half now, right after this musical break. So again, thank you so much for joining us, and we'll be right back. We'll be right back.
talking to the Lama, talking to the Lama, singing to the Lama, being to the Lama. Oh, yeah, oh, it's to the Lama when I die. Singing Jerusalem, shouting Jerusalem, praying Jerusalem, higher, oh, Jerusalem, when I die. When I get down to the river, I'm gonna stick my sword in the sand. By the old ship of Zion, she took a minute to the promised land. Way over in Beulah, sing it off everywhere. Way over in Beulah, I have boys of friends I've known. They've been gone, not gone on to glory. Well, a long time ago. They've been waiting, they've been watching, they've been waiting at the beautiful day. And one day I'm gonna meet them. Oh, I'm gonna sing forevermore. Talking to Jerusalem, singing to Jerusalem, big Jerusalem, high up, high up, Jerusalem, when I die. Oh, yeah, yeah. Big Jerusalem, singing to Jerusalem, shouting to Jerusalem, singing to Jerusalem, high up, high up, Jerusalem, when I die.
We are back on Sacred Ground Radio. That was Walk in Jerusalem with the beautiful, beautiful singer Mahalia Jackson. Welcome back, Congressman Ali, as we continue our discussion on geomancy and jinn spirits. One of the things that was mentioned in the chat room, which I do believe is an incredible resource, is the book Throwing the Bones, How to Foretell the Future with Bones, Shells, and Nuts, written by Catherine Ironwood, Conjurman Ali's co-host on the Lucky Mojo Hoodoo Rootwork Hour. It is truly an excellent resource to understand these kinds of connections that are being drawn between geomantic divination practice and Dilogun and Hathoramo, and understanding how sort of various divination forms that are using either curios or dots, a lot of them very mathematical when it comes to our understanding of them, to arrive at these diagnoses and prognoses that Congressman Ali is talking about here, which are just incredible. One of the things that was mentioned in the chat room was whether or not these prescriptive measures are still as popular today amongst practitioners of Hathoramo, or are people coming in simply sort of just wanting the divination side, and then they're sort of going to go about Western medicine, just sort of a pure Western medicine understanding of how to actually go about resolving their problem?
No, they're very popular. Hathoramo is a living tradition in the Middle East and North Africa, and they are very much associated with healing practices that are quite popular to this day. They're folk healing, so it depends on which region you're in. It depends on which area you are, what your upbringing in. For example, you may not find a lot of folk healing in an urban city, but you'll definitely find it in the rural areas. But even in the urban city, for example, Cairo has a rather strong tradition of Hathoramo. You can get your a reading in Cairo if you know where to go. Marrakesh, you can also get a reading there very easily. So even in large cities, they're still very much alive and well. But they do vary, and it depends. Certain areas, I think it's fallen out of favor a little bit more. For example, you won't find Hathoramo very much in Lebanon or Syria as much. However, teacup readings and coffee readings remain very popular there. But Hathoramo, not as much. You don't see it practiced very often. But you see it certainly in North Africa. You definitely see it in Central Asia and Iran. And Pakistan as well has a really strong tradition of Khatal Ramal, though they just call it Ramal. And they continue to practice the art.
One of the things that was asked by Troll in the chat room was whether or not geomancy differs for sand as compared to soil in its rudimentary practice, or is this unimportant?
Oh, it's unimportant. People use sand, soil, all sorts of things. And most people, for example, I'll give you a story. In Pakistan, what they do to do Khatal Ramal reading is on the side of busy roads where there's really dirt. It's not sand, it's not soil, it's just kind of dirt. What they do is they have a bowl, and the bowl is a jinn bowl. It's got a spiraling script on it, and that's to call in the spirit of divination that they work with, also to do certain healing practices, and then the anointing is filled with water. That's set to one side. Then they use their hand, and they flatten out the dirt, and they cast the chart with their finger right in the dirt there. In Egypt, it's done, but a man sitting on a chair, and he has a stick in his hand, and he'll lean over into the sand itself and make lines. He'll cut into the sand itself. So no, there isn't a difference between sand, soil, or anything like that. People use any medium nowadays. And again, dice are used and pen and paper nowadays as well.
One of the questions I have is, now, in the United States, as I'm sure in many places of the world, we have an issue between people who are actually practicing the craft from a place of devotion and skill, and then we have individuals who are charlatans, not necessarily people who simply aren't doing a very good job, but their goal is not to provide anything of help. It is simply to, mm-hmm. you know, take people's money. Is that mm-hmm. as common in amongst geomantic practitioners in these traditions or in these various cultures as we would find in the, amongst, say, bad charlatan tarot readers in California?
I would say that any tradition is open for exploitation and abuse. Any spiritual tradition, any religious tradition. So certainly it happens. But I would say it is of a different quality there. One, because they are lineage-based, you have to be able to say who your lineage is, and you have to be able to mention the ijazah you have. So there is a kind of check that exists there as well. The second check that exists is the financial one. A lot of local practitioners practice off of donation. So it isn't common for them to be overly wealthy or to set rates or things along those lines. And more often than not, it's very small things like we'll invite you over to dinner, or we'll bring you food, or we'll barter, or here's a donation of a few currency, or whatnot. So those kind of act as checks against rampant exploitation and charlatans, but they certainly exist. They absolutely exist. Any spiritual tradition will have space for charlatan exploitation and abuse.
But these have done like really great checks and balances that help to ward against that. We're only tarot readers in the United States be able to say, well, you know, part of my legitimacy is, you know, I'm connected to something larger than myself. That sounds like a really, really helpful way of warding against exploitation, although, of course, not warding against it entirely. Another question that someone mm-hmm. has in the chat room is, what are some of the signs of authentic Ramal readers? You know, if you were... What are you looking for as an expert in this tradition? Mm-hmm. If you were to look for a diviner, what would you say are some of the most important aspects of that?
There are several cultural markers that you can look for. First and foremost, Khatal Ramal is practiced in a certain way, which involves invocation. Khatal Ramal is not done just, you know, willy-nilly. There is often a quiet invocation that's done beforehand. That you can tell. If a person is doing the quiet invocation, like, okay, they're part of the culture. So there's cultural markers first. And second, as mentioned before, you can ask lineage-wise. And some of these are local lineages, so you'll know, oh, yes, I knew your great-grandfather. He was a skilled practitioner. Okay, he passed it on to you, I see. Others are more widely
known. So, for example, my family tradition is a little bit more prominent. And so when I mention my lineage, so when I say Abdul Khaliq al-Sherwaki al-Chisti, this is a wider lineage that someone in Afghanistan will recognize, someone in Iran will recognize, someone in South Africa will recognize. But then there are also the licensing, right? So you go, do you have an ijaza? And a lot of times the licensing is actually quite literally a physical document, a piece of paper. And other times it is, a reference to lineage. I used to have my ijaza through, the Al-Qadri line in whatever, whatnot. So those are the kind of markers. You can ask for, their credentials, if you will. And then there's cultural markers themselves that show the sign of a good practitioner. An invocation before the chart is actually made. Then speaking to the chart, that's the other thing you do. The geomancy is a dialogical process. They're talking to the spirit that they're working with, right? So you'll see an almost invisible conversation going on, or a one-way conversation going on. And that's another cultural marker that they are practicing within the cultural thread or stream of Khatazama. Another question that was asked in the chat room is, are there any really well-known readers? Now, I know that you mentioned that in Afghanistan, where you didn't mention your lineage, that people would, mm-hmm. a lot of people would recognize that and say, oh, yes, I know the line that you're from, a very well-known Hathorama readers. Are there any individuals who are sort of just really well-known, like, back in 1820, that person was such a well-known practitioner? Are there any names that are highly lauded in Afghanistan, I guess, in particular, that you would could point to?
Yeah, there is a lot of famous practitioners, some of which are historical figures, some of which are living figures. Obviously, not to toot my own horn, but I'm one of the well-known geomancy practitioners in the Middle East under my name there, Sheikh Ali. Al-Chistia, I'm known there. Abdul Khaliq is another very, very famous practitioner. People who, talk about Abdul Khaliq know who they are. And historically speaking, people like Ahmed Al-Buni, who's known more for astrology, but he was also known as a fantastic geomancer for people who, know of his tradition. So people will mention Ahmed Al-Buni as one of them. And there is a lot. Because this is such a wide tradition and a very popular tradition in the Middle East, Al-Zanati is another one that comes to mind at the moment. He's a historical figure who also wrote about geomancy. So there is a lot of that. And people who work within this tradition recognize those names and know the big names, so to speak, in the same way that certain psychics in the West are known, right, or certain tarot readers in the West are really known, as well as certain astrologers are really well known.
Coming back to the place where jinn spirits and geomancy intersect, we have a question in the chat room as to whether or not among jinn spirits, actually, before we even get to that quick question, let's sort of, for people who haven't heard the last episode, can we do a quick recap on jinn, which, in my understanding, are spirits of the land. They are history embodied, mm-hmm. Land
yeah.
spirits embodied, and are not mm-hmm. just found in the Middle East or in the Arabic world, but are found around the world. And for those of you who are might just be tuning in, definitely, because we can't cover it all right now, definitely listen to this last episode to get probably the most full breadth of understanding of these spirits that has ever been given in the West. we are so truly privileged to have had that conversation, that last episode. But what would you say, in addition to, I'm sure, the mistakes I just made in my last sentence, what would you say is sort of a brief recap as to what jinn spirits are?
I think that you perfectly encapsulated what they are. They are very clearly spirits. I would call them psychic spirits of sorts, because in the tradition that they belong in, there are kind of three realms: the realm of spirit and light, which is the realm of angels, the kind of psychic realm, which is the realm of jinn, and then the material realm, which is the realm of humans, though humans exist on all three levels as well. And there are these psychic spirits. They belong to this psychic realm. They are elemental in nature, meaning that they are tied to the land, to the forces of the elements, to wind and fire and smoke. They exist around the world, come in a variety of different shapes and forces and forms, I should say. They have their own class system, if you will, their own classifications and personalities and characteristics. Some of them are vast cosmic beings that can shape the very foundation of our world. Some are earth-shattering spirits that can cause earthquakes and tornadoes and massive change, and some are smaller creatures, more mischievous, that exist in the house, in the home, and hide your socks. But they are very deeply tied to also memory and history. They represent a sort of ancestral nostalgia, a remembering of a different time, so to speak, of a time where man was one with nature, a time of caravans, a time of communion with the land that was not always romantic, don't get me wrong. It was also a time of death and fear and getting lost and whatnot. But they do represent that sort of ancestral mystery that's tied to land and memory.
And they're far more complex than we in the West have been led to believe by such movies as Aladdin, which my partner was recently pulling up a YouTube video of that very, very last iconic scene where Jafar gets his final wish, which is to be an all-powerful genie, and he grows as large as the cosmos and does some great elemental work between his hands and says total cosmic power between Aladdin puts him in his itty-bitty living space inside a lamp. For those of you who are simply listening to the show and have never been in the chat room, I highly suggest that you do listen to the show while in the chat room, if you can sometimes, because some of the Arabic terms and names that Conjurman Ali is sharing with us, he's actually typing out in the chat room. So these are highly, highly valuable. Again, if you can join us some week, do so, because between the resources and links that are showing up, it is a highly valuable resource to be in the community of folks who are in the chat room. Someone else asked in the chat room, among jinn, is there a hierarchy?
Yes, there is. And I think this really is tied to the cultural perception of the jinn themselves. The jinn tradition comes out of the Middle East and North Africa, and so the hierarchy that people see in the jinn reflects that society. It tends to be deeply related to tribal culture. The jinn are believed to exist in tribes with sheikhs of their own, chiefs of their own, as well as having some elements of courtly culture. There are jinn kings, for example, and jinn princes. And there is a hierarchy among them. And to work with them, you have to understand that hierarchy. Who you're going to go to, who you're going to appease, who you're going to call upon when you're in trouble with a jinn. So understanding that hierarchy and the dynamics between jinn is very important to working with them. And some of this hierarchy is tied to the classes of jinn themselves, the ghoul, the ifrit, the jinn, and the marid, these different types of jinn that are classified by scholars of the jinn. And some of it is tied very clearly to either a court culture or a tribal society.
And as we were discussing in the last episode, we are now at a time in terms of globalization where jinn experiences of jinn that in the West, whereas they might have been significantly less, say, even 12 years ago, are now significantly more frequent as American soldiers have been entering into the Middle East, not, you know, for various, you know, this is a political show, but we'll refrain from being extremely political at this moment. But they're coming back with things that they didn't go there with.
That's a great question, and that's absolutely true.
And someone asked, and we absolutely don't want to relegate these spirits only to a place of fear, because obviously there's reverence. There's reverence going
mm-hmm.
on. There is mm-hmm. Consultation going on. There is
mm-hmm.
deep connection to long history and land that these spirits are a
mm-hmm.
part of. But the way in which Americans who are experiencing djinn are often experiencing them is not necessarily through these powerful, emotional, revelatory ways. It's often through, oh, fuck, there's something wrong with me because
mm-hmm.
X, Y, Z. Someone mentioned, and we never got to this question, which I think is actually really important, what are some of the signs that someone might look for if they are, say, being harassed by a djinn spirit? I know that I mentioned some of my own experience the last episode, but what are some of the other things? How would someone say, okay, this is not an issue
mm-hmm.
of soul loss, or I'm sure divination is important here, but what are some of the signs
mm-hmm.
that someone might say, aha, maybe I need to find someone who can actually divine with this cosmology in mind?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's a fantastic question. There is a few signs that give them away, and I should say that I have had people ask about the djinn long before the kind of geopolitical issues going on, mostly people interested in learning about them, but there has now become a vast population of people who need djinn exorcisms that come from the American military or the Western military. I've had some British clients as well. And it's because of their connection or their experience in that particular region, the land responding back. And one of the things that becomes very apparent quickly is their influence on emotions and thought. And this is why I call them very psychic spirits. There is a certain psychic vampirism sometimes that goes on with the djinn because they have a deep connection to the human psyche. And they are quite blatant spirits sometimes. When they want to show their power, they'll show it in very overt ways. They're not shy. But they're also extremely cunning. And they can lay dormant and subtle for many, many years, just nudging things along until they get what they want. But one of the most obvious signs is uncontrollable passion and uncontrollable thoughts. So depression, lust, fear, these type of emotions that become destructive and deteriorating, that take over and really almost consume a person's life. They exacerbate mental conditions, too, that they make things, if a person is inclined to something, like post-traumatic stress disorder, they will make it worse. They're very good at exacerbating things along those lines. And how you know it's a djinn versus other spirits is that they often won't respond to traditional ways of trying to get rid of them. Or if they do, it's very temporary. So cleansing work will remove them, but not for a long period of time. They, because they're cunning and persistent, they find a way of kind of sneaking back through the cracks or disappearing for a period of time and then coming back. And so it is, it's really kind of a difficult process. It's not like, oh, okay, I know immediately that a djinn's there. No, it takes a bit of time. You'll notice that you're not yourself or the person in question is not themselves, that they're losing some type of emotional battle. And traditional means of helping them, therapeutic means and spiritual means, just isn't working. And then the second question is, what is the connection? Like, do they have some type of experience with the djinn? Where would they have been exposed to the djinn, right? So the practical questions are there. Did they disrupt a ruin? Did they go into a natural site and desecrate it? Things like that are another way of asking or another qualification to look for. And then at that point, it would be wise to get a reading from a person who works in those traditions to see if there is indeed a djinn present. Now, one of the things you said is let's not create a great deal of fear, and that's, I think, absolutely true and very important to point out. I will say that though there has been a rash of soldiers and Americans who are now experiencing the djinn, it still remains a relatively unknown phenomenon. I would say that a large percent of clients who come to me go, I think I have a djinn, I often say, no, you don't, right? So it isn't as widespread as people think, so I don't want mass panic to be going on, or to think that every spiritual intrusion automatically equals djinn. That's not the case. But they do happen, and they are growing in popularity.
Well, you know, I almost feel like both of these episodes have answered this question, but I'd love to just put it out there, really just bluntly for you. there are people in today's world who are not at all from any traditions that in which the jinn are revered or worked with, and they are going to want to work with jinn. And now this is going to be from a place of ambition, spiritual ambition. They simply, you know, mm-hmm. want to, you know, play with power. But then there are people who, mm-hmm. as we find in every culture, people are drawn to, you know, for emotional, mm-hmm. spiritual reasons, things. They're drawn to places. They're drawn to work with certain traditions. Is there any way for someone who isn't a part of these traditions or growing up in cultures in which jinn are worked with and revered, is there any way in, or is it just a stay out, don't be foolish?
No, I am not a particularly exclusive type of person by nature. And I really do believe that, especially in this global world, that we can learn about traditions that are outside of our own and cultures that are outside of our own. I think it's a great thing. I am hesitant. I always question intent and motive first and foremost. If you're looking for the next cool thing, this isn't for you. I'm sorry, it's not. It's a lifelong process. It's a commitment. If you're looking for the ooh, spooky, mystic orient, definitely not for you, and you're probably racist. No, I'm kidding. But I couldn't help but to throw in an orientalist joke. It's just my feature. If you are interested in sincerely learning about this tradition, then you've got to have to ask yourself a couple things. One, are you willing to really commit yourself to it? Because it is commitment. Take a look at my life. I had to give up a childhood to learn this tradition. Now, I say this without regret. I'm not saying, oh, I didn't have a childhood, poor me. I love my childhood. But it was a commitment. It's from a young age, I had to be trained in these arts. I had to learn years and years spending time with mentors from Ghana and North Africa, from the Middle East, who would teach me things like, okay, today we're going to memorize these 65 stories associated with this figure. Okay, so are you willing to do that? Are you willing to learn a different language and culture? Are you willing to learn about a different religious tradition, right? You've got to be able to move beyond your own perspective. So commitment is the next question. And then if people are interested, and the answer is yes to all that, yes, they're willing to do all those things, they're willing to really dedicate themselves to finding the Christ, I see no reason why they can't learn. But you'd have to find a real practitioner. You are not going to learn this from a book. You're not going to learn this online. You're not going to learn this from searching the internet. You're going to have to find a real person. I do take on students under the jinn tradition. However, I only take them on generally face-to-face, that meaning that I have to meet them. It's not an online thing that I can do. You can live long distance, but you do have to travel and see me. I have to get to know you, and I am very selective in who I teach because of the questions that I asked earlier about commitment and dedication and intent.
I'm glad that you're saying everything you're saying. I did recently come across an online course. I won't mention exactly any of the names associated with it, but the course was titled, it is titled, Jinn Power, Magic 101, and the description of the course is, would you like to harness the power of the jinn to manifest your desires? And having had these conversations with you, my mind says, I don't think that that's what it's about. These don't seem like pet servants. Would you say that description and title alone is a run the other direction issue?
I would be hesitant myself personally. I don't know the course, so I can't speak to it. I haven't taken the course, so I can't speak to it. And I'm one of those people that I give people a fair shot, right? Maybe it is legit, maybe it isn't. I haven't, so I can't speak to that. What I can say, though, is that in the West, in the United States, there are 4 or 5 practitioners with authentic ijaza. That's it. Anyone else claiming the tradition is either learning from books, making it up, or doing their own thing. Now, their tradition may work. I don't know, right? There are traditions out there that try to create a Golden Dawn-like system that replaces Goetic spirits and angels with the jinn. And maybe that works for some people. Maybe that's what they're looking for. This is a wide, pluralistic world, and there's room for all of us. But if you're looking for traditional gin practice, there's only four or five of us, a small handful of us here in the United States, and we're very selective of the type of students we take on. You're not going to find that tradition online. It's not something, because there's practical elements. You just can't teach certain things online. And even a book will have certain limitations. And that doesn't mean a book is impossible. You certainly can write a book on it. But there are certain things that require person-to-person interaction. For example, there's something known as the barakat. The barakat means blessing, right? But it's a form of, it's an actual force that has to be transmitted person-to-person. And it involves touch. If I'm giving someone barakat, I have to touch and blow my breath upon them. You know, technology is fantastic, but I can't do that via email, via Facebook Messenger. You know, I'm not blowing on a computer screen. I need that face-to-face interaction. So these are the type of things that you have to really kind of ask about, you know, when you see online courses, is what happens to this other aspect of the tradition? Well, how do I get that? You don't, right? So I would always urge, whenever anyone says that they can teach you gin magic for a couple bucks or dollars here, because at the end of the day, there's more to this tradition than signing up for a course. It takes a long time. And again, not saying that it's impossible to make a course out of it or a book out of it. It is, but there's certain elements that really require you to have face-to-face interaction and, more than anything else, cultural immersion. This isn't about lesson plans. It's about learning cosmology, language, and culture.
Well, you know, I want to agree with everything you're saying, but I'm not sure if you recently heard that there is someone who is selling a Ziploc bag of air from a Kanye West concert on eBay. I think that technology has definitely grown to the point where you can mail someone some barakat.
How am I not surprised?
We'll be right back after this next song. Thank you so much once again for joining us.
grave is kept clean.
Fine production of the LMC Radio Network, whose art and information may be found on its webcast shows. The LMC Radio Network is a community radio alliance of metaphysical, spiritual, inspirational, and political justice broadcasters spanning a wide range of topics. Tune in Sundays for the Lucky Mojo Hooter Rootwork Hour, hosted by Catherine Ironwood and Conjurman Ollie. It features panel discussions on traditional African-American hoodoo spellcasting with members of the Association of Independent Readers and Rootworkers, plus free readings and magical rootwork advice for live call-in clients. This is the longest-running conjure show on the planet and may be heard from 3 o'clock to 4:30 Pacific Time Sunday afternoons. On Mondays, get ready for Candelo's Corner. Starring Candelo Cambisa and Malik Cambisa, this is the voice of authentic Cuban Palo and Dominican Sanse in the United States, with special guests representing the entire range of African traditional and diasporic religions. You can hear Candelo's Corner Monday evenings from 5 to 7 Pacific Time. On Tuesdays, a pair of outstanding hosts point the way to essential values. First, on the Crystal Silence League Hour, John St. Germain provides spiritual guidance in the practical use of crystals and crystal balls for the development of mental concentration, mind power, divination, and telepathic communication. His show airs Tuesday evenings from 5 to 6 o'clock Pacific Time. Once you have your bearings, engage in activism and social justice in the streets with Beverly Smith. Beverly brings listeners front-page reports on the ongoing struggle for racial, gender, and social justice, shedding much light on civil and social rights issues. Her cry for freedom begins at 6 p.m. Pacific Time and inspires us for 1 hour. On Wednesdays, Andrea Weston's Liquid Libations pour forth to bless us with poetry, short stories, and spoken word performances. If you are a poet or someone who simply enjoys the beauty and power of words, then Liquid Libations welcomes your participation. Call in and read your work. Listen for Liquid Libations on Wednesdays from 5 to 6:30 p.m. Pacific Time. On Thursdays, from deep in the heart of Texas, it's the Now You Know Show with Professor Porterfield. In a variety show laced with country wit and biblical wisdom, the silver-tongued professor shares his knowledge of roots and delivers the lucky numbers. From 6 to 7:30 p.m. Pacific Time, there's no end to the surprises. All shows on the LMC Radio Network are sponsored by the Lucky Mojo Curio Company, located in Forestville, California, and online at luckymojo.com. Add 3 hours for Eastern. Tax and license may apply. Train departure times and Burma Shave signs subject to change without notice. LMC.
Lucky Mojo Curio Company is located in sunny Forestville, California, and is the proprietor of so many incredible products that are excellent for remediating all kinds of conditions. Check them out online at luckymojo.com or come visit them in person and see the world's smallest church, Missionary Independent Spiritual. I am Kai Arman, and we are back on Sacred Ground with Conjurman Ali discussing geomancy and jinn spirits and Islamic culture. And again, this is some of the best conversation that you will ever be able to get your hands on here in the West, here in America, on these topics. Again, Conjurman Ali, thank you so much for coming on twice to share your breadth of wisdom regarding these traditions, regarding these spirits, that not only might we know what we are faced with when dealing with Mali, but know just how rich the world that we live in really is. And again, as I said before in our last segment, that I know that, you know, there are people who are drawn to traditions. I know myself, I'm drawn to traditions that are outside of my culture, outside of,
right.
you know, that I didn't grow up with in Far Rockaway, Queens. And it's been important to me to find ways to connect with those traditions and places in a good way,
mm-hmm.
in an intimate way, for the fulfillment of my soul and my
mm-hmm.
personal joy. And when we were doing some screening, and while these great songs were playing, a lot of people would have been wondering, what was that last song that was playing? That was See That My Grave Is Kept Clean, but it is not by Blind Lemon Jefferson. It is actually a later version of that excellent song. But as we were talking about some of the questions that we have left that I was most excited about you addressing before this show came to an end, why do Jin want to work with us? Why do these magnificent beings that are so vast
mm-hmm.
and have hierarchies and what about us draws them to us for this symbiotic relationship to work out?
That's a fantastic question. And, you know, I first have to clarify that not all of them do want to work with us. Some jinn find it distasteful, and this is why it's very important to know about this tradition really before you get involved, because you can't just call the jinn willy-nilly. Some of them can be quite dangerous. Some of them have no interest in us whatsoever. Some of them are so ancient, they're as ancient as the mountains. And what would a mountain have any interest in a human to, you know, similar along those lines, is some of these jinn have no interest, but some do. And why they have an interest is because the relationship is symbiotic. They do get something out of it. They get fed, they get offerings, they get fruits, they get bread, they get dates, they get, a pact that ensures that they form a spiritual kinship with us. So they find a family of their own. So a jinn may make a pact with a whole family, and their descendants will be his descendants or her descendants, and they will be connected to that, as well as recognition. Those jinn that come through for humans over and over again are what anthropologists call performer saints, and they gain fame. This is the jinn you go to because he or she always comes through. And this is also related similarly to a question that Cass asked about the Karin or Karina. To start working with these spirits, you first have to find out your personal jinn, the Karin or Karina, who is tied to the Greco-Roman concept of the Kako demon or the daemon. And this is a personal jinn that exists in your life. Some of them are helpful, some of them are a little bit more mischievous and tricky, but you first start working with them. You find the connection with them, and they become the intermediary to the wider jinn world known as Al-Ghaib, the hidden world. And again, it's through tradition and knowledge that you find out who you can work with, who you cannot work with. Because not all jinn are interested in. But once you find the ones that are, it develops into a very powerful symbiotic relationship that can only be equated to spiritual kinship. They become part of your family. They become part of your blood.
You've also mentioned there's a personal jinn that is,
mm-hmm.
I want to imagine everyone has one.
Yes.
Okay, and people can get a reading with, say, someone as yourself to find out the name
mm-hmm.
of that spirit.
Mm-hmm. That's absolutely true. The Karin or Karina. And this is the personal jinn, again, tied to the idea of the daemon or Kako daemon of the Greco-Roman tradition. It's a personal spirit that exists with you, or in the Middle Eastern tradition, which is also tied to the Islamic tradition. There's an idea of multiple spirits existing in your life. Some of these spirits are angels, some of them are jinn. And the idea is that they are multiple. It isn't one. So it differs from the kind of holy guardian angel tradition that we see coming out of the Western esoteric tradition. And in it, you have a multiplicity of angels and a multiplicity of jinn that you work with. But one of them, the Karin or Karina, is really the personal sonic spirit, or the spirit that really is connected to the world of the jinn. Well, you have to find out their name, find out if they're friendly, or build a relationship with them, and then through them gain access to the wider jinn world.
Interesting. What resources? No, I know that there's
mm-hmm.
one of the books we talked about before in our last episode was the book Legends of the Fire Spirits, which doesn't tell one how to work with jinn spirits, but it definitely brings
mm-hmm.
in a great many narratives
regarding working with Jen. It's by Robert Ledling.
Yes.
Are there any resources that you would suggest
Tahir
for someone?
Shah did the forward.
I'm sorry, say that one more time.
And I said that Tahir Shah did the forward, who is the son of Idris Shah, one of the prominent Sufi writers of Islamic mysticism and magic.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you for that. And I know that you've also shared that that Arabic folktales, 1001 Arabian Nights, that these are also really useful places for people to look who are wanting to familiarize themselves with the spirits and the traditions that surround them. Are there any resources that you would suggest for people who are wanting to look more into geomantic divination? I know that someone mentioned John Michael Greer's book, The Art and Practice. I believe it's titled The Art and Practice of Geomantic Divination. What would you suggest as a longtime practitioner?
I would absolutely suggest John Michael Greer's book. It's a fantastic introduction. And again, it's Western geomancy, so it's not going to be the same as Khat al-Ramal, so it is a bit different, but it is a great, great book on that. There's another book by Stephen Skinner called Geomancy in Theory and Practice, which is more of a history book or a textbook on geomancy. It does talk a little bit about the practice of it as well, but I would recommend that book if you're interested in finding out some of the history of Khat al-Ramal itself and how it correlates to geomancy. If it comes to practice, John Michael Greer's book is fantastic on that. But if you're interested in Khat al-Ramal more than geomancy, then you're going to have to speak to a living practitioner or hope that one of us living practitioners writes a book in the future about Khat al-Ramal.
Well, we can definitely hope for that. Will such a book be coming from you? Is that a hope that we can have?
I have definitely considered it. It's the only problem I have is that I have so much to write that I need to figure out how to narrow it down into a workable book. So I am definitely considering it.
And you would say that you have students right now that are working on developing relationships with their personal jinn, working in a jinn tradition. Do you take on any students either for learning geomancy in its sort of Western form or Khat al-Ramal, you know, do you have students that come to you? I understand that these are connected. Do you have students that are coming to you to learn about working with jinn, of which Khat al-Ramal will play a part, or students that might be sort of learning geomancy, and it's like, you know what, things are leaning in this other direction. We're going to have to go a bit more technical here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do take on students for Khat al-Ramal only. And I do take on students for the jinn tradition. They do blend towards one another, but not everyone is meant to become a jinn conjurer. They may not go on to study the depths of jinn conjuration, but they will be exposed to the knowledge of the jinn and what it takes in order to be a successful practitioner of Khat al-Ramal. So there is some blending, but I do take students that are just interested in one or the other.
We are being joined by the wonderful Catherine Ironwood, who just is on the line right now. Catherine, are you there?
Yes, I am. This is a great show.
Oh, lovely chat.
I have a question. I want to keep this. Oh, thanks. Well, I want to keep this real brief, and I just want to get to a question that I have. Countryman Ali, you said that you take on students. We know you live in Southern California. What I'm curious about, because if someone wanted to study with you, they'd either have to live in Southern California or arrange to stay and study for a while. How long would it take a person to study with you, get the personal breath that you mentioned, and so forth? What could they expect if they knew you, you know, online or through Facebook or through the radio show network? How long?
You know, that's a fantastic question, but I don't have a clear answer to that because I teach in apprentice-style format, which doesn't mean you don't have to live here, but you do have to be willing to travel frequently here, or I will travel out to you frequently. And it is more of a lifelong process than it is a period of time. I wouldn't be able to say, like, oh, I can teach you this in 6 months, or I can teach you in a year. It's much more, I will continue to teach you. I will teach you the basics. I say the basics you can learn within a year. But after that, I will continue to teach you and guide you through the process because that's how I was taught. I'm still in contact with my teachers, some who have passed on.
I see. So they would be prepared to, say, live in Southern California and hang around with you for a year, and after that, y'all would be best buds, and you would, they'd
exactly.
be part of your tradition. Okay,
exactly.
So 1 year, that's a good thing, because I know I'm asked this by people. They think they can pick up a book and, you know, learn everything. And, you know, the other question I had was, and I know this is going to be a touchy question, I'm going to be real just blunt about it. Do they have to be Muslim?
You have to be comfortable with the Islamic tradition, because the jinn practices have interwoven quite strongly with the Islamic tradition. But you also have to be very comfortable with a spiritual form of Islam, Christianity, and Judaism, because all three religions feature quite prominently in the jinn tradition. You do have to be comfortable with it. You have to be willing to learn Arabic. You have to be willing to recite certain verses. But you certainly do not have to be Muslim in the sense that you practice the five pillars of Islam or practice the faith.
All right. Well, that was one of my questions. Thanks very much. I really appreciate it, because I know there are people who will want to study with you. And I think one of the bigger hurdles, no intent to offend, will be the religious question. And one of the things that I just wanted to point out is that being open to religions is sometimes the best way to approach another culture, rather than to rush into a conversion. That's just my opinion.
Absolutely.
And you know, if one is going to be led to being interested in this and it leads one to Islam, well, then that's the path. But you're saying they don't have to be an actual Muslim practitioner in order to learn this work of divination.
Not
all right, thanks a lot. I'll get off the line and let the next caller come in. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kat.
Love
thank you so much for joining
you
us.
Great
Kat.
Show. Great show. Bye-bye.
Cousin Ali, I'm sorry, but I just had a whoa moment when I heard you say that Christianity and Judaism also play a role. Are we going to have to do two more shows on this? I'm a little worried. I don't think we've covered that.
That's the nature of these things, right? There's always more to talk about, and there's so much to talk about, but how do you cover it all? But I'm always happy to come back, always.
Okay, well, that's so good to know. Thank you so much. We have caller from the area code 917, Andy, U.S. Are you here, caller?
I am. Hi, Kai. This is actually Andrea from Liquid Libations. You know, I couldn't miss your show.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, always, always. I'm totally enjoying the past two shows. So thank you, Conjurman Ali, for the information. My question is, in terms of having a personal jinn or deciding that you want to learn more, work with jinns, how do jinns work with other spirits in your court? So let's say someone is scratched in Palo and they work with Congo spirits, and you've got members of your personal spirit court and your ancestors. How do jinns work side by side with that? How does that work, if you can go into it in brief?
That is such a fantastic question. And as a person who is scratched in Kimbanda, a Congo tradition, I can speak to it. They work really, really well with other spirits. There's very few spirits they don't get on with. And you'll know some of them. Sometimes they don't get on with some saints. They're not overly fond of certain saints, especially those saints that have a tradition of being crusaders against the Moors, for example. They don't tend to get along particularly well with that. There's a history there. But I can tell you that they get along with the Congo spirits very well, because the Congo have their own jinn tradition in which some of the spirits of the Congo are equated to the jinn. And the Islamic and jinn practices of the ATRs is a hidden history that is often deeply overlooked both in Brazil and Cuba.
You know, that's very interesting, because my personal feeling about jinn and Congo spirits, I just never had anyone that I could ask the question to.
Mm-hmm.
I feel, I guess intuitively, that they almost go hand in hand.
Yes,
and that
they
is an easy thing to work side by side. So you have just answered a deep probing question that I probably had for about 3 years. Thank you.
Oh, wonderful. I was glad to help. Thank you for your question.
Thank you. Thank you so much
for joining us.
Thank you, Kai. Absolutely. Thank you, sirs.
Next up, we have area code 832, Frank Rising from the chat room, joining us on air live. Frank, are you there?
Hey, I'm here.
Thank you
so much
for joining us.
How you doing, guys? Kai, great show.
Pleasure.
Conjurman Ali, great to hear you. wonderful educational stuff.
Thank
I have
you,
a very basic question, okay? And that would be pretty much if someone is drawn to the jinn but has no basic prior knowledge, but through trickle-down aspects in different cultures and other people, where would be a good place to focus to learn, you know, a basic roundabout about this culture? Because it's very interesting to me, and I have some people who are within arm's length of me, a few steps away, who are talking about doing crazy things like drawing a jinn to their property to protect their property, and I'm kind of wondering if that's really a great idea. I think that might not be the smartest thing to do because they know less than I do, and I'm freely saying here this is all new to me. I'm learning everything here, so I'm wondering where is a good place to start.
That's a great question, and I think the best way to start is cultural immersion of some way, shape, or form. Don't try to divorce these spirits from the cultures that they're associated with, the North African cultures, the West African cultures, Central African, the Middle East, the Levant, South Asia. Learn those cultures first and foremost. Pick up books about not just the jinn, but the cultures themselves. Legends of the Fire Spirits is a great book. Another one, a more academic-oriented book, is Islam, Arabs, and the Intelligent World of the Jinn by Amira El Zain, which is a fantastic, fantastic book. The Arabian Nights is a great way of understanding culturally the folklore and the stories behind it. And then go out and meet people. I know in this digital age we're very afraid to get out from behind our computer screen, but the computer office is a fantastic way of meeting people we wouldn't normally meet. Make friends who are practicing the jinn practices, who are involved in that culture. Learn more about the lore, learn more about the history. Don't try to rip them from that cultural background. And then if you're meant to be in this tradition, you will find a teacher. I firmly believe that you will.
Yeah, that's one thing I was going to bring. That your answer reminded me immediately, like, how would one go about finding a teacher? Because it's not the kind of thing that's very, at least to where I am, it's not a commonplace practice. And if it is, it's not the kind of thing that people really broadcast or mention that they're into. So
right.
That's like this character. I know this guy that he wants to draw a jinn to his property, to protect his property, but yet he knows really nothing about them at all. And he's asking me where to go hook up with somebody who can help him. And I'm like, I'm not real sure what to tell you because it just, like, you get what I'm saying here. If I want to find a practitioner like that, what would I do? I mean, is there a signpost?
Right.
Is there?
Well, I firmly believe, I'm one of those people that firmly believes that if you ask for a teacher and when you're truly ready for a teacher, you will find them, whether it's me or someone else, you will. And I really believe that. And if you don't, I would take that as a sign, right? I would take that as a sign that your interest may be there, but maybe the path isn't for that person. I would not encourage someone to try to draw a jinn to their property without knowing what to do. It's not a wise practice. But I do. The teachers are out there, and they're willing to teach, and you'll find them. I really do believe you'll find them. But you first start at the basics. Don't go jumping into conjuration without even understanding the language and the culture and the history and the lore behind them. And I think that's very unusual. You know, you wouldn't dive into doing advanced quantum physics without first taking, you know, algebra and basic math. Same thing.
I've always wondered what this fascination was with this guy for wanting to do this, because it's not something that I would personally ever do. You know, you have, like you're saying, I would want to at least have a little bit of an idea of what I'm talking about before I even ask anything in to draw in something like that. So basically cultural immersion is what you're saying is the best way
to go. Absolutely, yeah.
Thanks very much, and thanks for the titles, because this has given me a lot of the book titles alone are just a lot of stuff to absorb and try to find, because it's not a subject that is touched on very much unless it's in small circles like this. So I appreciate you all very much.
Well, thank you for your question. It was a fantastic question.
Thanks very much.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Okay.
And Cosmin Ali, people can contact you for a reading to ask, you know, is this path right for me? What can I expect from pursuing this path? And they could also contact you if they wanted to know the name of their personal jinn. That's something else that they can ask you for, correct?
Absolutely. That is a service that I provide people, and I'm happy to take a look and see if the path is for you and if what the name of your personal gin is, which is the first step, right? Finding out if it is for you, finding out if it's going to be a successful path, and finding the name of your personal gin. I'm a very inclusive and open person, and as long as you show a sincere interest and your intent is in the right place, I think that everyone can benefit from learning.
Once again, thank you so much for being such an incredible, generous resource. For those of you who are in the chat, for those of you who are listening, Conjurman Ali can be found at theconjureman.com. He blogs at ravenconjure.blogspot.com. And if you need a little bit more of him than just when he blogs, then you get to hear him every single Sunday on the Lucky Mojo Hoodoo Rootwork Hour at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern on blogtalkradio.com, where he joins co-host Catherine Ironwood and a special guest from the Association of Independent Readers and Rootworkers to deliver live, on-the-air readings using geomancy, tarot, throwing of bones, you name it, they're using it, and providing remediation advice. It's phenomenal. And for those of you who do listen to that show, I'm very grateful that I get to join such lovely Tauruses on that show.
And we love having you on that show.
It's always so much fun. Conjurman Ali, thank you again so much for joining us this week to do a part two, so that we can really delve in, as the show is just, the mission of this show is, what are we not seeing? What don't we understand? What are we not looking at? How can I say I love you when I don't know where you've walked,
mm-hmm.
as one of our special guests brought to us some weeks ago. Thank you for helping us to know where we all have been walking for such a long time. Truly,
thank you. It was an honor. It was an honor, and thank you for such a fantastic show. You really are providing an amazing service. It was an honor to be here.
Thank you. Thank you again. Again, this has been another wonderful episode because of our special guest, Conjurman Ali, of On Sacred Ground, broadcasting live at 12 p.m. Pacific, 3 p.m. Eastern, every Saturday. Tune in, join us in the chat room where people are answering questions and asking great questions and posting resources and links. Do join us. For those of you who just sort of catch us in the archives, try to make it sometime. Again, this is your host, Kai Armand. Thanking you so much for patronizing this show. It's been truly a beautiful journey thus far, and I'm excited about what's to come over the next few months. And this is Kai Armand signing out. Be well and blessed.